Christian group, or is it a net, or is it from all over?
I think it's from all over, but our group meets just outside of Houston in a little town called League City, between Houston and Galveston. So,
oh wow,
yeah. But we have people since we've gone online that have joined us from all across the nation. So it's good.
That's good to know. I will pass on your Zoom information. I'm Carolyn Green, and I'm a very grateful member of the Omega Al-Anon Family Group, and Omega's a Dallas group, actually. I live in Garland, but my group's Dallas group, and it's always a privilege and an honor to be able to share with others what this program has done for my life. I don't know where I'd be today or what my life would be like, but I guarantee you, I would not have the life I have today. I would probably be a very unhappy, miserable, hard to live with person, I'm sure. Anyway, I'm so grateful for the Al-Anon program. I have been this weekend at a conference, actually. The Gathering of the Eagles conference. It meets every year in Dallas. And it's been so good to be there in person again. Oh my goodness. We've all been so happy to be able to meet in person. And sharings have been just wonderful. And it's just good. This program has done so much and gives me so much. So when I have an opportunity to give back, I am always grateful to be able to do that. When I got to Al-Anon in 1978, I walked through the doors of Al-Anon October 1st, 1978. I had grown up in alcoholism. My mother grew up in alcoholism, and her mother grew up in alcoholism. And one of the first things I remember them telling me, or one of the first things I remember hearing in the first couple of meetings I went to, is that that alcoholism is a family disease. And that if you don't get help, you just keep passing the disease from one generation to the other. And after being in the program and being able to recognize my part of the disease of alcoholism, I realized that a lot of the isms were passed on to me from my mother and my grandmother. I was very close to my maternal grandmother. And so the isms, the craziness, the I, self, and me things that I experienced, that's what I grew up with. A lot of my mother's family, and they still are this way. I'm the only one in recovery in her family. Boy, they could hold a resentment like, oh my goodness. I had two aunts that I adore, both of them, and they held a resentment toward each other for 3 years. I mean, they would not speak to each other for 3 years over something, you know, I don't even know what it was. It was just ridiculous. But anyway, As I watched them do that, I just kept being more grateful for this program, that I've learned to let go of those resentments that come up. I don't want somebody that means that much to me and that I love that much to hold that kind of resentment toward them anymore. I don't have to do that today, because I have tools that this Al-Anon program has given me. So I've learned how to let go of the resentment and get past it and get on into forgiveness and having a relationship again. But anyway, I grew up in alcoholism. My mother and dad, neither one were alcoholic, but they married, divorced when I was a very young girl. I wasn't even in school yet, but I remember the ugliness of their divorce. And because it was a lot of yelling and screaming and blame, a lot of blame. And they, it was a very a fearful time for me. And I didn't, as a young girl, I didn't know what was going on. As a young kid, I didn't understand what was happening, or that they could, why they were getting divorced and they weren't going to be together, and why they were acting like they were toward each other. But anyway, for years as a young girl, I remember every now and then we'd go back to court because they were always fighting over custody of who was going to have custody of myself and my brother. I have a brother 3 years older. So just a lot of ugliness that went on, and blame and things like that. So then when I got to be a teenager, right before my teenage years, my mother, and this was part of her resentment toward my dad, she and my stepfather moved off to Denver, Colorado. We'd always lived in Dallas. She moved off to Denver, Colorado, and she told us that that was to get us away from my dad. She did not want us to be able to go over to my dad's every other weekend. And so she moved us off to Denver. And after a year, my brother came back down. He was old enough to make a decision for himself, and he came back down to Dallas, and I stayed up in Denver with my mother and my stepfather. Now, I believe my stepfather was alcoholic, and that's why I say I grew up in alcoholism. Now, one of the things I also heard when I was new to Al-Anon was that we don't make that decision for someone else, that alcoholism is a self-diagnosed disease, and that, and what I realize today is if the alcoholic doesn't think they're alcoholic, there's not any help from anybody. So I guess that's why it's not, we're not supposed to make that decision. But anyway, but I heard early on, going to open AA meetings, I heard an AA say that if you walk like a duck and quack like a duck and have feathers like a duck, you're probably a duck. And I want to tell you, there was a lot of waddling and quacking and feathers flying in our home as I grew up as a young girl, as a teenager especially. And because of all of this stuff that went on between my mother and stepfather over his drinking, he'd come home drunk and there was always ugly fights. She would throw him out and threaten to divorce him, and then she'd take it back, and then she'd throw him out, and then she'd take him back. The typical things that a lot of us Al-Anons do. And because of all of this, I made up my mind as a young girl that I just needed to get out of that home. I was looking so forward to graduating from high school and getting away from that craziness in my mother's home. And now my stepfather was always good to me. He was a drunk, and he and my mother had a lot of problems, but he was always, always very good to me. He was a good stepfather. But anyway, I made up my mind I wasn't gonna, and my mother did a lot of screaming and yelling at us kids also when we were little. So I made up my mind as a young girl that I was never gonna marry anybody like my stepfather. I was never gonna marry a drunk, and I was never gonna be like my mother. I wasn't gonna yell at my kids. I wasn't gonna yell at my husband. I was always gonna be this loving, understanding wife. And so right the summer, right before my senior year in high school, my mother and I got in a large argument. She was very, very much a controller. Had through that last year, the previous year to this, there were friends she told me I couldn't be friends with anymore. It was like, and what I realized today after being in Al-Anon, because it happened to me, the more out of control things got at the house, the more she tried to control. And I did the same thing right before I got to Al-Anon. The more things got out of control, the harder I tried to control it. And the more it got out of, it was just a vicious circle. And so she was very controlling and had, like I said, told me I could, taken away a lot of my friends and all of this stuff. And so I was just, I just wanted to make it through my senior year and get away. I just wanted to get away from that home. And so this night, right before school started, before my senior year, one night, my mother and I got in an argument. Now, she was also the kind of person that I never argued with her. Until this night, I had never talked back to my mother because she was one of those people that if you did, you'd just get knocked down. And but this night, we got in an argument and I started yelling back at her and she was yelling back at me and she picked up a glass of water and she threw the water in my glass of water in my face and picked up the broom and started poking at me with the broom and said, go to your room. And I went in and sat down on my bed. And the next thought that crossed my mind is, when they go to bed tonight, I'm getting out of here. I had enough. I just wanted out from under all of that yelling and screaming and pressure and control. I just wanted out. And the next thought that crossed my mind is, if I wait, I won't go. And I got up off the bed and I walked toward the living room and walked toward the front door and I hit the front door running with the clothes I had on my back. And I had no idea where I was going or what I was going to do. I just wanted away from her. And there was a young girl that lived a couple of blocks from me that was one of the friends of mine that she told me I could no longer be friends with. And I thought she probably won't think to look for me there. And I went to this girl's house and her mother let me spend the night. I don't know why I look back now at the happenings and think, you know, it's just amazing. But anyway, her mother let me spend the night. And the next morning when I got, and I called my dad. Now we were in Denver. My dad lived in Dallas. And I called my dad. I didn't know what else to do. I was afraid of what my mother would do to me if she found me. And so I called my dad that lived in Dallas and I said, I want to come to Dallas. Because I thought that was the only thing I could do to get away from her. And he said, I told him I'd run away, that mom and I had an argument. I told him the whole story. And he said, I want you to think about it overnight. And if you feel the same way in the morning, your brother and I'll drive up and pick you up. Well, I didn't think I had a choice. You know, one of the things Al-Anon has taught me is I have a choice. I always have a choice. I may not like my available choices, but I always have a choice. But I didn't know that. I thought the only thing I could do was to get out of Denver. And so I called my dad the next morning and he said, okay, we'll come get you. And I had friends that hid me out for 2 or 3 days until my brother and dad could get up there, but they drove up and picked me up. I cried all the way from all the way from Denver to Dallas because I really didn't want to go. I was looking forward to my senior year and all the senior activities. And I had a boyfriend at that time that I thought I was in love with, you know, and I really didn't want to go, but I was afraid of what would happen if my mother caught me. So I came to Dallas and was living with my brother. He was married then. And a month later, this young man that I was dating came down to Dallas. And when it was time to put him on the bus to go back to Denver at the end of the weekend, we didn't want to put him on the bus. We wanted to be with each other. I mean, oh my goodness, young love, you know, when you just think all you got to do is just have each other and everything is great. And somehow, I don't know how we did this, but my dad has passed now. I wish before he had passed, I had asked him. But somehow we talked my dad into helping us to get married. So the deal was, if we could just be married, he'd go back up to Denver and finish his senior year up there. And I would finish my senior year in Dallas. And then after we graduated, we could be together. Now, I don't know why that sounded so good to me, except in my mind, I thought, this way I won't lose him. You know, if we're married, I won't lose him. That was my whole thing. I was afraid of losing him. So anyway, my dad helped us get married. We put him on the bus, sent him back to Denver. And in a couple of weeks, a marriage license came in the mail. And I wrote him this letter and told him how beautiful the marriage license was. And Well, his mom and dad found the letter. And he always said his mom's arm fell off when she found the letter. And they said, "You're married, go be with your wife." So they packed him up, sent him back to Dallas on the bus with the suitcase full of clothes and three packs of cigarettes and sent him back. And that's how we started. We had absolutely nothing. At the time we lived with my brother for a while. Harry found a job. I found a job. That's how we started off. And we were together. Oh my goodness. I always say we need to if we could bottle that feeling that you have with that new love, oh my gosh, if we could just bottle it up and bring it out 40 years later when we need it, or not even 40, maybe 10 years later when you need it, it would be so helpful. But anyway, that's how we started life. And things were okay. We had each other, and so we thought everything was fine, and we rocked along, and we had people. I can look back now and see that God put people in our lives all along, because there was a young couple that we knew that, they were our parents' age, really, but a couple that kind of took us under their wing and encouraged him. We went back and got our GEDs, and then they encouraged Terry to get some college. And so that's how we started. And our life was just gradually getting better, you know, because he was working hard and everything was going fine. And we did a lot of partying. Every time I look back now, and I know every time we got together, I had cousins down in the Dallas area. And so we'd get together with other couples, and we always had liquor. I never thought anything about that. I wasn't going to be like my mother. I wasn't going to say you can't bring liquor in the house. And besides that, at that time, it wasn't a problem. It wasn't a problem to me. So anyway, about 4 years after we got married, our first daughter was born. And 2 years later, our second daughter was born. And the responsibilities started setting in. You know, until then, we were just two young kids playing house and having a good time. But then the kids came along, and there were bills to be paid and responsibilities to be met. And I became responsible. Oh, dear. You know, I became responsible, but he was a young budding alcoholic, and he wasn't ready to settle down and be responsible. And so that's when his actions started becoming a problem to me. And that's what happened. And it really wasn't the drinking. It wasn't drinking. It was that he was going out. I didn't realize it had anything to do with the alcohol, but he wanted to go out and party with his friends. And of course, I couldn't go because we had two young kids, and he was spending money that I felt like we didn't have. And so it started becoming a problem to me. And I want to fast forward now to right before we got in the program. And by the time we got to AA and Al-Anon, my girls were ages 10 and 12. So one of the things I heard also is that the alcoholism is a progressive illness. It's progressive. It just continues getting worse if there's not help, if you don't find recovery. The disease itself just continues getting worse. And I can see through the years how his drinking increased and kept increasing. Because when we were a newlywed couple, we'd buy maybe a pint of something when we'd go to a party, maybe a six pack of beer. Well, by this time we were buying a fifth of something and maybe a case of beer if we went to a party. So the progression was happening, and it was affecting our lives. The fact that he'd call me a lot of times and say, "Can I go out and have a drink with the guys?" Now, I was going to be that loving, understanding wife. I wasn't going to be like my mother. I always said yes. I wanted to say no. You need to come home and be a husband and a father. But I never did, because I was a people pleaser and I wanted to keep him happy. And I wasn't going to be like my mother. So I always said yes. And I would say, "Please call me if you get hung up so I won't worry about you. And he'd say, okay. And about 11 o'clock at night, he'd call me and say, I'm going to have one more drink and I'll be home. And I'd say, okay. And in my mind, one more drink meant about an hour. You should be home in about an hour. And so 12 o'clock would get there and he still wasn't home. And 1 o'clock would get there and he still wasn't home. And 2 o'clock now, I had a job at this time. My kids were in school and I had a job. But I was still up at 1 and 2 o'clock, pacing the floor and watching for him. And finally, about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, he'd finally roll in. And it was like my mouth was attached to the doorknob. I would tell the kids could see, the girls could see that I was upset when they'd go to bed. And they'd say, Mama, please don't fuss at Daddy tonight. And I said, I'm not going to fuss at him. Just go to bed. Everything's fine. I'm going to bed. But, you know, I heard an alcoholic say from the podium that when they had promised their families that they weren't going to drink anymore, at that moment, they meant that. It's just that the obsession with alcohol was greater than the promise they made to their family. And that's the way my promise to my girls was when I would say, I'm going to go to bed. I'm not going to fuss at him tonight. And I meant it when I said it. But my obsession with him, where was he? Who was he with? How much money was he spending? Was greater than that promise I made to my girls. And so when he had walked through the door, it was like my mouth was attached to that doorknob. I'd be all over him. You know, where have you been? How much money have you been spending? And the fight would be on. And we'd yell and scream and slam doors and throw things at each other. And horrible. Quite often on Friday nights, he'd call me at the office before I left office, and he'd say, would you go by the liquor store on your way home and pick me up a fifth of scotch and pick you up some wine for this weekend? And I'd say, sure. Now, I wanted to say, no, I'm not going to do it. We're not paying our bills. We can't afford to buy. Liquor was a luxury as far as I was concerned. I don't think he felt the same way about it. But anyway, I wanted to say no, but I never said no. I always said, sure, I will. Now, I did that for one reason. I thought if I went to the liquor store, I'd be in control of the amount of money that was spent on liquor. And I was I had a terrible fear of financial insecurity before I got to this program. So I was trying to control this active alcoholic, and I was trying to control how much money we were spending on liquor and everything else. I mean, I was insane. But anyway, I'd go by the liquor store. Now, he had asked me to buy him a fifth, but I had figured out that it was cheaper if I bought it by the half gallon. So I would buy him a half gallon of scotch, and I'd buy myself a half gallon of wine, and then I'd take it home and I'd say, okay, this must last for 2 weeks. Now, that sounded like a reasonable length of time to me. That's a lot of liquor. And by Monday morning, it was gone. By Monday, it was Monday. And I would say, how did we go through all that liquor? And the big book says that alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. But for me, the alcoholic was cunning, baffling, and powerful. He could always outthink me and always outtalk me every time. And he'd always come up with some excuse of where, you know, don't you remember so-and-so came by, blah, 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 blah. And what would really happen is after he finished off his half gallon of scotch, now I'm talking about from Friday afternoon to Sunday night, he would finish off my half gallon of wine, and he'd tell you today that wine he didn't particularly care for. But if that's all you got, that's what you got. Now, I realized today there was a lot of drinking from Monday to Friday, but I didn't know about that. I did discover also right before we got to the program at one time that he had a account at one of the liquor stores in Dallas. And I just went berserk over that. But anyway, I was trying to control the situation. And like I said, the more I tried to control it, the worst, thank God. So anyway, and he could always outthink me and always outtalk me. So our life was getting more and more chaotic. Now, I remember at the time also thinking that nobody lived like we lived. Now, I grew up in all of this. I grew up in this kind of stuff. But I didn't think about that at the time. I just, you know, I was trying to hide it. I didn't dare go tell anybody what was going on because I didn't think anybody else lived like we were living. And finally, and I was getting sicker. I was getting more and more emotionally and spiritually sick. And finally, I got to a place and I had absolutely no idea it had anything to do with alcohol or alcoholism. But I finally got to a place where I knew that I couldn't go on living like we were living. I'm going to try to, there you go. My screen went down for a minute. And I was just beside myself. So one night, in my desperation, there was a lot of craziness going on in our home. And like I said, the more I tried to control what he was doing and what was going on, it just got worse. And one night I felt so bad and I finally got in the car. And the only thing I knew to do was to drive down to my dad's house. He lived about an hour and a half from my house, from where we live. And I drove down to my dad's house and I started telling him what was going on. And everything I said to him, he said, that's typical of an alcoholic. That's typical of an alcoholic. And the only reason that I know that he knew anything about it was because he had a brother-in-law that was in AA in California. And his brother-in-law, just a few months prior to this, had come to visit him and my stepmother and was having a hard time staying sober. So they put him in the car and they drove him up to the pressing group in Dallas to get him help. And when them, my dad and stepmother, as being the family members that brought this alcoholic in, they gave them some Al-Anon literature. And my dad had that Al-Anon literature there that night. And one of the pieces of Al-Anon literature he had was a merry-go-round named Denial. And so he talked to me and he said, I think it's alcoholism. And he gave me this piece of Al-Anon literature. And I went home and I remember reading that pamphlet, The Merry-Go-Round Named Denial. And when I read it, what I did is I found Terry in it. Yeah, he does that. Yeah, he does that. Yeah, he does. I could see all of the stuff that he was doing. So a couple of weeks later, one morning after one of our usual fights, and we had a fight almost every morning, you know, and we would send the kids off to school with him and I yelling and screaming and slamming doors, and quite often he would jump in the car and squeal the tires and leave. And there were many mornings at that time I had a friend that I finally started telling her some of the stuff that was happening. And she told me I was too easy. And she said, you need to put your foot down. And obviously she doesn't understand alcoholism. It never helped me to put my foot down where that was concerned. But anyway, so a couple of times I tried to show him that I was angry, and I would jump in the car and try to squeal the tires, and I never could. And he told me after we got in the program and he heard me tell that from the podium, he said, my little car didn't have enough power to squeal the tires, but I wouldn't have known how to do it anyway. And I'd get mad and I'd get so caught up in that argument that we just had this yelling, screaming argument, and I'd forget. And I would be driving and thinking about that. Next time I'm going to say this, and next time I'm going to say that. And I would forget to watch my speed. And I ended up with 3 speeding tickets right before I walked through the doors of Al-Anon. My dad was an attorney and he got me off all 3 of the speeding tickets. And I always said, I'm never going to let him come to Al-Anon because he may learn to let me accept the consequences of my own actions. And I would be in trouble. But one of the amends I made to my dad after being in the program was I didn't get any more speeding tickets. But, you know, I would be so angry. one time right before, just maybe a year before getting into the program, I was in a terrible accident because of my anger about something he didn't do. I mean, it totaled my car. It was a very bad accident, and it was over my anger. But anyway, so these crazy things were happening in my life, and my dad gave me this Al-Anon literature, and I took it home. And a couple of weeks later, after one of these morning fights, I got to the office, and I didn't call Al-Anon. Now, I had this piece of Al-Anon literature from the Preston group, and I guarantee it had their phone number on it. But I called the AA intergroup office, and I wanted them to tell me what to do about him. And the lady there said, if somebody's drinking is a problem to you, then you need Al-Anon. And she gave me two numbers to call, and I talked to two Al-Anons on the phone. And these two ladies shared their experience, strength, and hope with me. One of them lived in Garland, where I live. And she invited me to a meeting at a group out here in Garland. And she described herself, and she said, I'll meet you out front of the group. And I'm so grateful. I used to hear a lot in the meetings that God gives us exactly what we need when we need it. And I know for me, I would not have walked through the doors of Al-Anon by myself. I came in with such a fear of people and such a fear of economic insecurity. I would have never been able to walk through the door had that lady not met me out front of the group. What these two ladies did for me on the phone is they shared their experience, strength, and hope, and that's what they gave me, is a teeny, teeny bit of hope that if it was alcoholism, because I still wasn't sure it was alcoholism, if it was alcoholism, maybe there was hope for us. Maybe there was another way to live. I went to two meetings at the Belmont group, two Wednesdays in a row, and they gave me a newcomer's packet. I had some other information, and one of my favorite things that was in that newcomer's packet was the Just for Today pamphlet, the little Just for Today pamphlet. You know, just for today, I will try to live through this day only and not try to tackle all of my problems at once. Just for today, I will be happy. I read those things on that Just for Today pamphlet, and they were foreign ideas to me. I remember laying there and reading those on that little pamphlet and wondering how I could get from where I was to being able to do those things that were mentioned on that. They were foreign. I went to two meetings 2 weeks in a row, and then I didn't continue going because I had asked them, I said, should I tell him that I'm coming to these? And they said, you know what? We can't give you advice. You have to make up that decision for yourself. I think it's great that we don't give advice in Al-Anon. I was never told I should do this or that. People might share their experience with me, but I was never given advice. I was maybe given a direction on something in the literature I needed to read or make more meetings or things like that. But nobody said, get out of a marriage, stay in a marriage, leave a job, anything like that. And I'm so grateful. But anyway, so I went to these two meetings. I did tell him, I decided I'd tell him I went, and he didn't like it. So I didn't keep going. Of course not. It was don't rock the boat in peace at any price. And I didn't keep going, but I had my newcomer's packet, and I kept reading it, and I kept reading it. And about a month after that, I finally got to a place where one more time I knew I couldn't go on like we were living, and I asked him to leave. And he moved out, moved in with a friend of his, and he was calling home every day. He was calling home every day, talking to the kids. And when I asked him to leave, I didn't ask him to leave because I wanted to sober him up. It was not about changing him at all. It was about I could not live like we were living any longer. That was all. I had no idea. I knew he may be glad to be rid of me because I had realized that I had become all those things that I hated so much in my mother growing up. So So he was out living with a friend, and he was calling home every day. And one night, the girls and I went to a friend's birthday party, and when we got back from there, we realized that he'd been by the house. And I put the girls to bed, and a little while he called me, and he said he wanted to come talk. And what he wanted to come talk about was getting back in the house. And I had read in the newcomer's packet or heard in those two meetings that you don't talk to the alcoholic when they're drinking. And so I told him, I could tell he'd been drinking. I said, no, I'll talk in the, we'll talk in the morning. And he said, fine. And he slammed down the phone. In 30 minutes, she showed up at the house. And, you know, I really believe because of the meetings and the newcomer's packet, for the first time, I felt compassion for him. For the first time, I could see his pain. I could see his pain. And I had no need to fuss at him or yell at him or say anything ugly. And because he could not take a fight with me because I wouldn't fight back, he started slapping himself. And he slapped himself so hard that his face was swollen. I mean, he was literally hitting himself. And about that time, here he was slapping himself, and the girls, we realized the girls were standing in the hallway watching all of this. And he stopped, and we put the two girls back to bed. And in typical alcoholic fashion, just go to bed. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. I mean, Dad's beating himself, but don't worry about anything, you know. And we put him back to bed. I asked him a few years ago, I said, did y'all go to sleep when they put you back to bed after all that? And, you know, they did. What a miracle. And then after we put him to bed, we went in and sat down on the couch, and he said, I need help. And I said, are you willing to go right now? And he said, well, there's no place to go. Now, I was in those two meetings. I heard him say that AA was always there. That's what I heard. AA is always there for you. And so by this time, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. I put him in the car and drove him over to the Belmont group. Now, and I thought AA is always there. I thought there was going to be somebody there at the group. We drove up to the group. It was in an industrial area. There were no cars, no lights. And I said, I think we need to go knock on the door. So we went up and knocked on the door, and in a minute, a man answered the door. And he said, can I help you? And I also heard in those meetings that it had to be the alcoholic's idea in order for it to work. So I, for the first time in a long time, I kept my mouth shut. And in a minute, he said, I think I might have a drinking problem. And the man said, if you'll wait just a minute, I'll let you in. And he went away, and he came back, and he let us in, and they sat down, and that alcoholic member of Alcoholics Anonymous talked to my husband one-on-one. That's how AA works, alcoholic sharing with the alcoholic. And in a little while, he looked at the clock, and he said, you know, it's 4 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and he said, I'm having a hard time getting my thoughts together. Would you be willing to come to a meeting this morning? There's a meeting at the Preston Group at 11 o'clock. So my husband agreed, and we went home. And because all of this had happened, I allowed him to sleep on the couch that night. And the next morning, that member of AA called him. He followed through on that 12-step call, and he called him to make sure he was still coming to the meeting. So we got in the car and drove to the Preston Group. Of course I went with him. Of course I did. And we got in the car and drove to the Preston Group that Sunday morning. And that's when he went into AA and when I went into the Al-Anon program. I'm so grateful I started at a group like Preston. It was a very strong group. The AAs and the Al-Anons worked together. They had open AA meetings. We had a lot of Al-Anon meetings. The nights we didn't have Al-Anon meetings, there were open AA meetings to go to. Every Friday night, and we were talking about this last night at the conference. Every Friday night, we'd go to a Friday night speaker meeting, open speaker meeting, and then we'd all go out for dinner someplace. Sometimes we'd take over a restaurant. Everybody at the group wanted to go to dinner. We'd go to dinner. And it was such a Well, it was life-changing for me is what it was, but it was a very special time. I'm grateful I started at Preston because they were big on talking in their meetings about the steps and the traditions and the importance of having a sponsor and the importance of being active in service. That it was a very strong solution-based group. And I'm grateful I got that kind of foundation. About a year and a half into the program, we were asked to be invited. We were invited to the beginning of a new group, of the Omega group. And I've been involved in the Omega group ever since. So we got active in our programs. He got active in his program. I got active in my program. About 9 months in the program, somebody at the present group took him aside. He had been asked to share his story from the podium, and she heard his story, and she said, "I need to tell you the rest of your story." She said, "The man that was there at the Belmont group that night was on the phone to this lady, and this man had a gun in a bottle because even in sobriety, life had gotten real hard. And what he had done is he had locked himself in the Belmont group that night when they closed up. He locked himself in the bathroom so they wouldn't know he was there, so he could sleep on the couch because he didn't have any place to go that night. And he had the gun in the bottle and it was talking to her. And she said, "What you need is a wet trunk to work with." And that's when we knocked on the front door. Now, I believe that that was God working in our lives and in his life. That man stayed sober, and my husband is, we're no longer married after 7 years of program. Terry left me, but he's no longer in AA, but he's not drinking. But I'm still in Al-Anon, and my life has been good since I've been in this program. I got here to save a marriage. That's what I got here for. My sponsor told me over and over again, it's not about saving marriages, it's about saving lives. But I still wanted it to save my marriage. And so after he left, I was really devastated. I was really devastated. Thank goodness for sponsorship and for the people in these rooms that they just rallied around me and held me up when I just sometimes didn't feel like I could continue going forward. And I became our GR and started going to assembly. I highly recommend service work. I believe at that time, this being active in service in the program, having responsibilities to fill for my group, was one of the things that kept me coming and one of the things that kept me so active. And so I believe it saved my life. I really do. And I would go out to assembly and I would be hurting so bad. And the people out there would just love me. You know, people would walk up to me and say, "Carolyn, are you okay?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I'm okay." And they'd say, "How are you really?" They could see it in my face. And they would, you know, then I would break out and tell them what's going on. And everybody would listen to me and everybody just loved me through it. The people that had already walked that walk were there for me. And I'm so grateful for that. And I always try to do that today for anybody that's going through any kind of loss, because that's very hard. Again, I'm so grateful I was active. My home group is Omega, and I've stayed active in Omega group. I've stayed active in service work. And I go to a lot of conferences. I go to, except last year, thank goodness things are opening up again. Zoom has been a blessing to so many people, I know. But I want to tell you, being at that conference this weekend, live with everybody there, it is just it's just good to be back. We were talking today at lunch about all the fellowship things that we used to do that we had to miss out on this last year and a half, I guess it's been already. But again, I know Zoom has been a blessing for so many. We have people that join our Zoom group from Houston area and also from Odessa area. So it is a blessing. But I am grateful to be able to start going back and meeting in person again. I've been very active in, I'm on the board of the Crested Butte Mountain Conference. That's been a blessing in my life. I've gone every, the first year I went was 1988, and I've been every year since, except the last 2 years that we couldn't have it. And that's a miracle in my life, because I came in with such a fear of financial insecurity, and the program has really helped me to walk through that. I know today, one of the things I worried about when I was new here, when I was new in the program, was would I have an hour a week? That's what I thought. I'd go once a week to one meeting. Would I have an hour a week? Could I spare that time? And a dollar a week to put in the basket. And today I go to, I attend three or four meetings a week, at least, sometimes more. And I know there's always, if I'm putting money in the basket, there's always enough. I have never gone hungry or not been able to pay the bills because of anything that I'm doing with this program. So I've been able to work through that, through the program and through working the steps in my life, especially the 8th and 9th step. I was able to heal the relationship with my mother. I've been able to heal the relationship with my kids because I caused a lot of damage. The part of alcoholism that was my part of the illness, the overreaction, the trying to control, the self-pity, the resentment, all of those things that I had to work through by looking at myself through working the steps. I was able to apply those to my life, and I'm able to, today, I was able to heal the relationship with my mother before she passed. I am so grateful for that. The program told me to let it begin with me. It said, let it begin with me. I was, by the time I got here, I still had a resentment toward my mother, and I thought she needed to make the first move. But you said, no, you need to make the first move. And so I was told to start trying to be the best daughter that I could be. And that's what I was. And I'm so grateful that I was able to heal that before she passed, because there was no regret and no wishing that things could have been different. We had healed our relationship. My girls and I today, they're grown, of course, and I have two grandkids and a great-grandson that I take care of, and we have a good relationship. That doesn't mean that we don't sometimes get crossways with each other, because that happens. But my program reminds me often to mind my own business. That's the best thing I think we can do when our kids are grown, is to stay out of their business. And boy, is it that's a hard thing to do when you see them going down a path that you know is destructive. Keep my mouth shut and mind my own business. I take care of my great-grandson 3 days a week. His mother's a nurse. And I was honored that she asked me to do that. You know, she trusts me enough to take care of him. I have since he was little. He's 7 years old now. And that's been a big blessing in my life. Like I said, I continue to be very active. I'm also on the board for Woman to Woman, the Texas Woman to Woman Conference. I highly recommend for the women, any of the women's conferences to attend. That's where I had a lot of healing as a mother and as a daughter and as a sister, to learning how to interact with the other women in my life in a loving, caring manner without trying to fix them, change them, or control them, but to allow them to be who they are and who God wants them to be, and to remember that it's okay to have a difference of opinion. I always thought that, especially when I was married, that we should always agree on everything, and that seldom happened, really. But I learned through the program to give other people the right to have their own opinion. I always tease and say, I can give you the right to be wrong and or to be right. You know, it's not all. I also know today that I'm not always right. I'm not always the way I see things. And what I know and what I've learned through Al-Anon is it's not always a right or wrong. Sometimes there's just two different ways to look at a situation. It's okay to have difference of opinion because we're different people and we all come from different backgrounds. This program is a couple of years ago, I went because I never got to graduate from high school. I went and enrolled in college. And in 2017, I graduated from college, and it was just one of those things that just kind of happened. It just kind of happened, but it was such a great experience for me, and such a blessing for me that I could do that. And I even walked across the stage in the robe and everything. All the young people, you know, I could have felt, thank God for Al-Anon, because I would have felt really stupid, except this program tells me I can do anything that I set my mind to with the help of God and with the people in these rooms. I go to Crested Butte Mountain Conference. I've been every year since 1988. And, We do a lot of fun things up there. I don't know if anybody's heard of it, but it's a week-long conference in July in Crested Butte, Colorado. And there's a lot of activities that they do up there. Some of the activities we do is we climb the mountain together. We go up this path to the top of Mount Crested Butte. We sit up on top of that mountain and have a meeting. And a few years ago, a lady went with me up to the conference and she said, let's climb the mountain. I'd never climbed all the way to the top of the mountain before then. And she said, let's climb to the top of the mountain. And I said, oh, you got to be kidding. That's always my first response. You got to be kidding. And she said, no, we can do it. So off we went. And we do it as a group. And so people were walking on this trail. The altitude up there is 11,000 feet above sea level. So being a flatland, they call us flatlanders, you kind of have shortness of breath up there. And so every now and then we'd have to stop and rest and take our breath. And we'd stop and people would pass us and they'd say, just keep coming. It's just one step at a time. And so we'd catch our breath and then we'd keep going and then we'd pass them. And it's okay, just keep coming. It's one step at a time. And by the time you get almost to the top and there's no longer a path. There's no path. There's just big boulders to climb over. And I remember stopping at the bottom of that thinking, oh, my God, what am I doing up here on this mountain? What am I doing up here? And she had already gone to the top and people were passing me. And I just, God, I was afraid. I thought, oh, my goodness, I don't know if I can do this. And there was a man standing next to me and he said, this is the first time I've climbed this mountain. And I thought, well, good for you. You know? And about that time, she called down and she said, Carolyn, as people were passing me, she'd say, watch the steps they take and take their steps. And that's what I did. And I got to the top of that mountain and I sat up on that mountain and I looked out and it was the most awesome experience. And I thought, with God and the people in this program, I can do anything. And that's what I felt. And I felt the joy of the fact that I found recovery and I found this way of life because it is a way of life. And the importance of suiting up and showing up and being there for the new people that come in. And I want to thank you so much for asking me to share my story today because it helps me every time I share it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. That was fantastic. Everybody, please join me in thanking Carolyn for her service tonight and her story.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you so much. Story. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thanks, Carolyn.
And Carolyn, I have been to Crested Butte. I've only been once, and it was about 7 years ago. And I know that exact climb that you're talking about, and I never made it past the big boulder. So kudos to you. That's amazing. It's a great conference. If you've never been, it's definitely worth your time and money to go. And thank you that you did not correct me, because I see now that it looks like you have the American flag on your shirt.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, but it looked pink. So, and pink is my favorite color, and sparkles are my favorite. So, thank you so much for joining us again. And Lisa, I will turn the meeting back over to you.
All right. Thank you so much. And if everyone wants to write what they write a little thank you to Carolyn, I usually send those all to our speakers in the form of a gratitude card. So
thank you.
I have opened up the chat so that you guys can write whatever you want on there. Thank you so much, Carolyn. I found a lot of my own story in your story. So I really loved hearing that and hearing your solution and service oriented story. I too am so big in service and love that you are too. And at this time, I am going to go ahead and put our share back up. Let me turn off the recording in just a second.